Gabriel Rovelli is one of the world's leading theoretical physicists and a pioneer in the area of quantum loop gravity. He is currently professor at the University of Marseille, where he heads up the Quantum Gravity Group, a distinguished research center. In this interview and discussion, he addresses why the question, why does anything exist at all, is an ill-posed question due to the problematic definitions regarding the constitution of nothing, why science should concern itself less with metaphysical speculation and focus on empirical observation to form theories and grand theories regarding any form of existence, the role of quantum mechanics in asking questions regarding existence, and his own unique insights regarding quantum loop gravity and the future of research in this area. Why does anything exist at all? It's a very complex philosophical question. People that work in cosmology and theoretical physics study this profound question. What can quantum mechanics initially say about why anything exists at all? How can we start thinking about this question?
Good. So I think the question why anything exists rather than nothing, it's a question that started in philosophy much before physics, and it has been revived in modern theoretical physics in ways which, in my opinion, has nothing to do with the original question. In a sense, the philosophical question and the physics questions are two completely separated questions. So I think the big question is ill-posed, is very ill-posed. And I think that the attempt to say that theoretical physics has an answer or tentative answer or something to do about it are very misguided and based on bad use of words. So let me try to say this a little bit better. In two steps, starting from theoretical physics. There have been a book came out not long ago in which a physicist, Krauss, argued that physics, cosmology, quantum mechanics has an answer to this. I may be straight. I believe it's bullshit for a number of reasons. The argument was roughly the following. If you have the theory of the universe, there is a state in the theory, so there's a possibility of things to be in a certain manner. And if you look into the equations, this state is called a vacuum. If you look into the equation, you see that there is a finite probability that the vacuum changes into a state in which there are particles, objects. So, in other words, it is possible that from a situation with no particles, say, the law of physics allow a transition to a situation with particles. So that's very good, very interesting. And this is certainly very interesting. It certainly has to do perhaps with what, certainly may have to do with what happened at the beginning of the universe, at the Big Bang. It might be that there was some sort of transition of this sort. So by itself, the physics is interesting. In fact, it seems to work pretty well to describe the universe, the use of ideas of this sort. We don't really understand it well, but in the calculations about the Big Bang, about the origin of the galaxies, the origin of our world, this possibility that a state called vacuum evolves into a state similar to the one in which we are, it's taken into account and seems to describe things well. Good. So this is the good part. What does it have to do with why there is something rather than nothing? Well, I would say nothing. Because the initial state of this transition is a state of a theory which we call vacuum, but we could also call the state one. The name vacuum is just a name for a state in a theory. In other words, before this transition, there's a situation in which there is stuff, which is the quantum field the theory is describing. There are law of physics. There is a universe. In other words, it's like saying it is possible that if I put a ball on a table, I don't know, because of some shaking around, the ball falls down. That's a possibility. Therefore, now I have discovered the production of balls. No, the ball was there to start from, and the universe was there before this transition. It was in a different state, maybe in a different universe, maybe in a contracting universe, maybe in some thing which we haven't learned to describe well. But definitely, one should not confuse the vacuum of quantum field theory with the nothing of question of the philosophical question.
So essentially you're saying it's to do with the initial definition of what constitutes nothing. So the vacuum energy is a state in itself, so that isn't by definition nothing. So you can't answer why something comes from nothing.
Exactly, precisely so. Quantum mechanics allows you to describe how something evolves in something else, but has nothing to do with why something emerges from nothing. The universe in the vacuum state is not a nothing at all. It's a universe full of virtual particles, full of things that happen, full of transition. It's a very full thing, the opposite of the nothing.
Just to tie into some aspects of philosophical definitions here. So you've said that the question used to be an old metaphysical, possibly metaphysical question, and now it's come into the domain of science, but it's not the same question anymore. Is this because, for whatever reason you think, or because that you don't think this question is answerable and makes sense? For example, as many philosophers say, it's the same as asking what colour is the number four? That doesn't make sense. Do you think that we have actual problems with the conceptual definition of nothing in the first place? Is that a problem or not?
Yes, I think you put the finger on right on the second thing I wanted to say. The general problem that comes to our mind when we hear this question, why there is anything rather than nothing, which is the big philosophical question, in my opinion, it's il posed. And it's one of these typically meaningless questions. As you said, what's the color of number four? I didn't think about that, but it's a very good example. What's wrong with the question, what's the color of number four? Well, it's that the notion of colors doesn't apply to the things which call numbers. So the question is just nonsense. Here, when we say why does anything exist rather than nothing, I think that we're using several terms, why, nothing, exist, which we don't understand and we're using wrongly. Let me say something about each of these. First of all, why? What we mean by why? Are we looking for a final explanation? Are we looking for a temporal explanation, low physics? Are we looking for what? I mean, what do we mean why? I'll come back to that. Nothing. What do we mean by nothing? The question presupposes that there are two possible states of the universe, two possible way of being of the universe, one in which there is a universe and one in which there is no the universe. But what is this no universe alternative? And the third word is existence. What do we mean non-existence of a universe? What do we mean existence of nothing? Is what do we mean by existence? Existence is one of these terms which is given for granted, the set of things that exist. And as soon as you just scrap it with the surface, you immediately see that we don't really know what we mean by something existing. Let me say a few examples. If I have this computer I'm talking to now, it exists, no doubt. Does this computer exist yesterday? Well, sort of. Does the northern wall of the Game of Thrones exist? Yes, of course it exists. Okay, so it exists. No, it doesn't really exist. Did Hamlet exist? No, it didn't, because it's an imagination of Shakespeare. But of course it exists. So we use exist in all sort of versions. And the idea that there is a clear distinction between existing things and non-existing things, it's not so meaningful at all. So starting by using three ill-defined words to pose a question, it's just getting in trouble to start with. But worst of all, I think that the answer, I mean, suppose we take these vague questions and we ask nevertheless, this is, why should anything exist at all? I think that the answer is, why shouldn't it? Why should nothing exist at all? In other words, the question presupposes that we know that there is a state of non-existence of things, which we don't know anything about, and that we know that that's a natural state, and the state in which we are is a special state, and so we wonder why are we in this special state rather than in the natural states, which is nothing at all. This is what had in mind the philosophers of the 17th century or 18th century where this was being discussed. But that's an enormous presumption about what we know about reality and the universe. Why should a state of nothing existing, so whatever that means, being more natural or being more justifiable that the universe we see around us, why should nothing exist at all? That would be very surprising. Suppose that to make obviously a nonsense scenario, suppose there was nothing, then we would argue, oh, why there is nothing rather than something? And we would equally surprised. Of course, we would be stupidly surprised because the situation cannot happen. We would not be there asking whether this is, so the very fact that we ask the question answers itself, right? There is a, of course there is something, otherwise there wouldn't be the question. So there is a tons of reasons for which the question is ill-defined. I think that when the question came out in classical philosophy, it was there to underscore the fact that this notion of reality is a set of existing things, it's weak. The question points to the weakness of sort of classical metaphysics. The question in reality should make us wonder that we might have to adapt our way of thinking about reality better to what the world is. The question points out to a confusion, to the numerous confusions we have in our way of thinking the world. I think what the question is saying is that stop asking why in that sense, stop talking about reality in that sense, and especially stop talking about vacuum, about nothing in that sense.
Very well put and very interesting in terms of the definitions of nothing, and perhaps we're making an error in the logical question of why, which leads me very nicely onto the next point, which is you've given us a relay of the problems that encompass this question, both historically and philosophically, and now how it spills into the scientific domain. And a lot of people have problems with the definition of nothing and this question itself. So as someone that works in cosmology professionally, how do you approach this in your work?
In a sense, precisely what I said before. I think that what modern, what contemporary theoretical physics is pushing us towards is being flexible about our metaphysics. In a sense, physics has always done this since the discovery that the Earth is round and is not flat. It's some metaphysical assumption, which are in reality just some normal intuitions about the world. We just look around us, get a sense of what we see, and make a picture about the world. And then we believe that that's the absolute reality, right? And the typical example for me is just we look around us and we see that there's a sky over our head. And so the universe has an up where there's a sky and a down where there's the earth. And this is the foundations of reality. And then this happened 20 and past centuries ago. Somebody comes in and says, wait a moment, the sky is not just up, is all around us. In fact, if you think about down, there should be sky again. And the Earth, there isn't an up and down in the universe. All directions are the same. Now, this shakes completely our metaphysics about the universe. We have to abandon this foundational character of up and down and realize that up and down just means toward the Earth and away from the Earth. And this happened 26 centuries ago in Greece when people realized that Earth is just a stone that floats in the sky, in the middle of the sky, is not something which is below the sky, which is upward. And then it happened again with the discovery that the Earth moves in the Renaissance. So people get convinced that the Earth moves because of Copernicus, because of Galileo. But then what it means to move? I mean, we thought we have a clear definition of moving, right? I'm here on my bed, I'm not moving. Just by definition, I'm not moving. So the Earth, by definition, does not move. No, well, it actually moves. But it moves or does not move? How could it move if I just define it to be not moving? So this confusion only points to the fact that we should abandon an intuition, a simple intuition about moving or not moving, and we should get a better understanding of that. So everybody who has studied classical Newtonian Galilean physics digests it very well, and we know that moving is relative, that velocity is not something absolute, it's something relative. So we understand that to say that something has a certain velocity doesn't mean anything. It's like asking, what is the color of number four? The correct question is, what is the velocity of something with respect to something else? This exists. this makes sense in our present description of the world. The velocity by itself doesn't mean anything. So good. We have clarified this, but again, we have changed our metaphysics. Now, moving or not moving means something else. And this has happened again and again. It's happened with quantum mechanics, has happened with special relativity, has happened again with general relativity. In a sense, it has happened even with Faraday and Maxwell, with the discovery of the electromagnetic field. We have changed our metaphysics of the world. We change what we mean of something exists. Does electromagnetic field exist? Yes, it does. Even if it is outside the simple sort of Newtonian metaphysics of space and particles moving on it. So the more we learn about the world, and theoretical physics is just a way of looking around and learning more about the world, the more we abandon the previous naive assumptions about the world, and we articulate a more, sometimes even simpler, but less intuitive, and more effective way of thinking about reality. So I work in quantum gravity, trying to put general relativity and quantum mechanics together, and this has a direct bear on the beginning of the universe, and therefore indirectly it approaches this question why there is something rather than nothing, because vaguely it talks to the fact that perhaps the universe before there was nothing, whatever this nothing is. Nothing means. And I think that science that I'm doing tells me, or tells us, is that we should not think about the world as a set of stones moving around, as we learned in Newtonian physics. So what exists as stones moving around in space, and go on from that. No, physics is much more complicated. Quantum mechanics tell us that objects exist in interactions. An electron that moves from the emitted somewhere and received somewhere else, it's not really somewhere between the two interactions. So already we get to a understanding of reality which is about relations between things. A little bit what happened with velocity before now becomes much more general. The position of the electron is only determined when it hits something else, in a sense. And in general relativity, we realize that space-time are not really some containers of the world. It's just relations between fields which touch or do not touch one another. So the entire space, spatial-temporal structure of reality, again, is who touches who. So instead of a metaphysics of existence, one goes toward a metaphysics of relations and facts and relational facts. We shouldn't ask what is there. We should ask what happens there, which is just a completely different thing. And what happens there, it's always happening with something else. So we should happen how facts affect one another. So in the physics that I do, this becomes very concrete, becomes a way of writing equations. The equations don't list objects and equation of motion for these objects, lists ways in which sort of subsystems affect other subsystems. Talks about probability amplitude, about processes. So we think of the world as a process rather than as a set of entities. And this moving from entities to process, from stones to interactions, it's, I think, characteristic of modern physics and totally changes the notion, the question of why there is something rather than nothing. Because now the something is not existence, is about processes. And the idea of nothing sort of vanishes in this picture. What we can ask is that given this process, what this other process, how likely is this other process of not? So modern physics, in my opinion, and in the physics I does, is very heavy on metaphysics in the sense that it requires us to abandon a lot of prejudicial ideas about the world. We have a lot of prejudicial ideas about the world. Things happen because something else happened before. There is before, there is later, there is time, there is reality, there is a unique time for all the universe, there is the up and down. Most of these are wrong. And of course, we shouldn't just throw everything away because then we're in the dark. Quantum gravity, which is the physics I'm doing, gives us a very different metaphysics, forces us toward different metaphysics, which it's probably not going to be the final one, but it's certainly going to be better in the sense of being more effective than the previous one. It's a step ahead to our understanding the world.
That's all very interesting, and it makes a lot of sense in terms of what you're saying about changing metaphysical questions, changing the landscape of reality and what we understand, whether it's counterintuitive, asking what is there instead of why is something there, which makes it would make the job of the physicists easier because it gets around this counterintuitive stuff.
Yes.
Even with that in mind, if you move from something like entities to processes to studying the empirical stuff that's really there and putting aside what constitutes this complex nature of nothing, doesn't that still fall into a problem of infinite regression? Because you can always be asking why, what happened before that, what happened before that, in terms of a causal chain? Or do you not even worry about that for the reasons that you've said, because we need to change the metaphysical question? So worrying about that this infinite chain of A causes B, so what caused A, that no longer is a problem because you think we should change the landscape of the reality we study. How would you approach that? Are you happy working in a domain where the chain of infinite regression is no longer important, or do you still think it is valid somewhere?
I think that keep asking why, it's always good in any case, because that's what moves science around. I don't think that science should aim at all at producing the final theory of the world. That's just a little bit silly, in my opinion. Science is about understanding better. Once we understand something better, we go through this, this is it. Yes, of course. I've understood this. Where does the water of rain comes from? I don't know. Oh, yes, I know. It's the water that has evaporated before from the sea and from the land. Oh, fantastic. I've got it. It's just the same water that circulates. I've understood something. I'm at the end of the story. No, of course. I mean, now I've asked other questions. I mean, why does the water evaporate? Because the sun hits it. Why does the sun hit it? Well, because sun is hot. Why is the sun hot? Because it's burning something. Oh, good, great. So I can keep going. And I can keep going this about the universe and about, we understand better and better and better. We get theories which are more and more powerful for describing the world. We are absolutely, in my opinion, far away from a final theory. The dreams of the final theory are very good dreams, but they're dreams. We are the amount of things we don't know about the world is still infinite. The temporal sort of infinite sequence of this happened because there was something before, what happened before, in my own opinion, has already dissolved, because the world does not evolve in time. In general relativity, there isn't a unique time in which things evolve. In general relativity, there are just relations between different variables. There isn't a preferred time variable. It's perfectly possible that there isn't a before of something, right? What happens on the Earth? You walk north, and then you walk north, and then you walk north. Well, you just get to the North Pole and then come down the other time. So there isn't an infinite. You get to the end of the North. The end of the North is North Pole, which is not a particularly strange place, just a bit cold, but it's not different from any other place of the world besides being cold. So it could be the same that if you go earlier in the direction of what we now call time, just get to a point where that earlier stops and you turn around and you go again toward the later. So it's not, in that sense, it's not necessarily a mystery. It's not something we haven't understood yet very well, but it's not a blocking point either. So my answer is double. Yes, let's keep asking more questions, but no, there is no obvious regression and infinity here. There's just it's just like getting to know something better and better.
Very interesting and well put. With that in mind, I suppose, talking pragmatically now, you've said why there's issues with asking this question in the first place, what we should consider when we try to answer this question, changing aspects of what we understand to be reality, and working on pragmatic issues that we at least understand and building on those blocks. So in terms of a pragmatic view, solely from your field of work, just if you could run through some of the stuff from quantum gravity and your work that cannot necessarily answer why anything exists at all for the reasons that we've been speaking about, but at least give us an indication of why we see a universe like ours, many other universes. What can quantum gravity at least help shed some light in this area, even if we can't answer a question that doesn't make sense?
Yes, quantum gravity is a tentative theory, of course, because I think it's important when we talk about contemporary physics to draw a line very clear between what we have understood and in a credible way, because we have made some hypotheses and this has given us some consequences and we have tested these consequences. So quantum mechanics is true in that sense, like Newtonian mechanics is true. It might have some domain of validity, but what the discovery we've made with quantum mechanics are true, and the same general relativity. There are holes, and we keep going ahead. We keep making hypotheses. The theories that go ahead are not yet confirmed. So we think they're right, but we're not sure they're right yet. And quantum gravity is among these. So given this sort of cautionary, preliminary remark, what quantum gravity is telling us is, again, it's not a total explanation at all of why the universe is what it is and what it is. But it's the best tentative description, in my opinion, we have so far about the world. And what do we have? We have quantum fields. We have fields like the electromagnetic field, the gravitational field, which are the best way we have so far for describing the reality. Which are quantum, so they are not to be thought as sort of existing out there, but they have to be thought as affecting one another in quantum interactions, which are probabilistic. There's no space, there's no time, there's no matter, because space and time and matter are just approximation of these at large scales. So in a sense, the world of quantum gravity is much simpler than previous worlds, right? In standard quantum field theory, you talk about particle physics, you have space and time and quantum fields. Now you don't have space and time and quantum fields, you just have quantum fields. Space and time are just a feature of one field, the gravitational field. So you have a quantum space of states of this. Technically, it's a Hilbert space. It doesn't matter much. So there are various manners in which these fields can be perceived by us or by any other piece of the universe. And there are probability transitions between these. So time comes later, space comes later, particles come later, classical fields come later. These are just approximation of the basic stuff the theory describes. And the basic stuff the theory describes, it's quantum fields in interaction with one another. Now, in the quantum gravity, in the theory that I'm studying, which is loop quantum gravity, there's a very precise description of all that. The states of quantum fields can be described in terms of graphs and things which are called spin networks. So these spin networks are possible states of reality, and we have transition amplitudes between spin networks, which are computed in terms of things which are called spin forms. And these are all combinatorial things, which are graphs with spins evolving into one another. And quite remarkably, from this very abstract mathematics, just graphs with spins, spins are just numbers, half integers, numbers. So imagine a graph which any link, there is a little one half, three half, four, five half, and so on. From the mathematics of these things, we can see from the equations that there's an approximation that describe the universe, expanding universe, the mountains, the objects, the world as we see it. So the world as we see it is an approximation from a mathematical structure which we have and with which we can compute also in situations when space is dissolved, time is dissolved, and matter particles don't make sense. So we have this theory. We are not sure it's correct, but we have a theory that puts together quantum mechanics and general relativity and allows us to, in principle, predict in a probabilistic way, as always in quantum mechanics, anything what happens. And we're trying to use this theory to describe what happened around the Big Bang, what happened in the core of a black hole, what happened in all the situations in the world in which the old theories don't work anymore, right? The standard quantum mechanics and standard general relativity alone don't work in the center of a black hole, or don't work at the beginning of the universe. Now we have a theory that apparently, at least, seems to be working in these situations. And in that theory, things are different. Space is not continuous. Space is discrete. It's a granularity thing because of quantum mechanics. Time is not a continuous unique things because this is what we learned from general relativity. All these things stay together. So we have grains of quanta of space, quanta of fields, which sort of interact with one another, and the probability amplitudes in some limit can be thought as evolution in time, but not generically. So this picture is based on quanta of space, quantum fields, so granular quantum fields are always granular, probability amplitude between different configuration of this, and that's all.
Now, what are some of the future work in this area, either from yourself, colleagues? I know you've said that all these different hypotheses in quantum gravity are still to be tested for various reasons. It's obviously problematic to do so, but what are some of the things going forward that you hope will bring additional knowledge in this area?
I think that the situation today, which is quite different than the situation 10 or even 5 years ago, is that loop quantum gravity is more or less complete theory. So it's a set of equations which could be a better description of the world, which include general relativity and quantum mechanics. So we have a theory. Maybe it has to be tuned, maybe it has to be changed a bit, maybe something has to be adjusted, modified, but the basic equations are written down, and it's not much. It's just 3 or 4 lines of equations, and that's a theory. Now, in my opinion, the main question is to test them and to find consequences, because until we have a successful prediction, we can be happy with these theories, with these equations, but we don't know. So I hope in the next years we get to some predictions. And the areas where this can happen are two, in my opinion. One is early universe. We have all these spectacular advances in observational cosmology, which look at the sky and see more and more what happened in the beginning of the universe. Well, I don't know if we should call it beginning of the universe. Anyway, near the Big Bang. So the theory can describe what happened there. So there's a big effort, a lot of people working on that, which is to connect the abstract theory with the concrete measurements done by Planck, by the Planck satellite, by the astronomers who observe the sky. And if all goes well, at some point from this theoretical paper, there should be some saying, look, this particular quantity, the spectrum you observe and the CMB in the cosmic microwave background should be tilted this way instead of that way. And if this is confirmed, that is going to be a strong confirmation of the theory. The second direction, which I'm very excited about, is black holes. Black hole is a fascinating object because there's a sort of something very peculiar about black hole right now. On the one hand, they have become normal objects, conventional objects, right? For astronomers, a black hole is, you know, that particular thing we see, that particular direction, which behaves precisely like Einstein theory predicts. You know, sinus X1, what is called, or the big black hole, the center of the galaxy, Sagittarius A star, I think it's called. This is a black hole and behaves like a black hole, and things fall into it. And the general relativity describes it very, very well. It fits exactly with everything we see. So we understand black holes remarkably well. There's nothing funny about them, except for one little question. You know, the why, perhaps you were saying before, that never stops. We see all this matter falling into black holes. We see in the black hole in the sky, we definitely see the matter falling in. We know, using general relativity, that it can cross the surface of black hole, go in a finite amount of time, go to the center of a black hole, And then what? We don't know. So what we don't know is what happened at the very center of the black hole. And that's not a small mystery, because that's where all the matter falls to. Everything falls to the very center of the black hole, and then we have no idea. We have no idea with the old theories, but with quantum gravity, we should have idea. If we have a theory describing quantum gravity, that's what it should tell us. So I think that one of the things to do, and some people are doing this, is to try to understand very simply what happened at the center of black hole when matter falls, use quantum gravity, compute what happened, and get some predictions and test them. And various people are doing that, including us in Marseille. What we think we understand is that quantum gravity produces a sort of pressure that stops the collapse. And there is a sense in which matter can bounce out. So at some point from the black holes, there should be things coming out. I'm not talking about Hawking radiation. I'm talking about things coming out predicted by quantum gravity. If this can be seen and measured, then we would have a big yes from nature, from God, from whoever, who says, well, this new set of equations actually works. And that's what I hope.
And some of this work, have you got any papers coming out soon with your colleagues, or is this a longer-term project?
We have papers coming out. It's also long-term projects, because it's a step-by-step things. So I hope that loop quantum gravity will be able to get concrete predictions from what comes out from black holes and from sort of quantum gravity effects in the very, very early universe. There's a stream of papers coming out from various groups. We are just one of them. Versailles, we're just one of the many groups working on that. We have even some phenomenological papers. I wrote one with Aurélien Barraud, who is in Grenoble, who does phenomenology in cosmology, with some numbers. I mean, there's some gamma ray that should be produced, that might be produced from exploding black holes. So we have some predictions of specific, wavelength and properties about gamma rays. Now the astronomers see a lot of gamma rays coming from all over, some of which are mysterious. So if we could connect some of these mysterious gamma rays to the theory we are describing, it would be wonderful. It's a beginning. These things go step in step. You know, you do a first prediction which is not very good, then you try to do another one which is better, and we're trying to understand better and better these objects. To me, the black holes are fascinating objects, because I think that's because of quantum gravity, not Hawking radiation, really because of quantum gravity, we should understand them better. There is no singularity in the center of black hole. There's nothing singular in the universe. There's no infinity in the universe. So the singularity at the center of a black hole should be tamed, resolved, and what happened to the process happening there should be computable using quantum gravity. Until our quantum gravity equations tell us exactly what happened and tells us exactly what we should see coming out of the black hole, we're not yet at the end of the story. And I put this as a challenge for ourselves in loop quantum gravity, which we are claiming we have a theory, and also for other people claiming who have a theory of quantum gravity. I string people claim to have a theory of quantum gravity. Can they answer this question? I don't think yet. And so them, like us, should work on that, should come out with a concrete prediction, not a wishy-washy prediction like everything comes out to faster. This is not physics. This is bad physics. Concrete predictions, like, you know, Einstein had general relativity and said, look, measure the deflection of light around the sun and you should get the number 0.2 or whatever it was, blah blah, and it was measured, it was that, exactly that. So until we get that, we haven't solved the problem, but it's a fascinating problem, and it is a problem that has to be solved, and it is an issue again. It's something that you see, the beauty of physics, in my opinion, is this: there's a concrete situation, what happens in the center of black hole, with a concrete prediction that we want, and at the same time, the theory, in order to solve this, asks to us to review our metaphysics of the world. Okay, so if this is loop quantum gravity is right, then our intuitive, simple ideas about time and matter and space are wrong, and are just approximation to something that the new theory describe. So at the same time, we get the little measurement 0.004 right, and we get a rewriting of our metaphysics in which questions about what is time, what is existing, what is a nothing, change meaning.
In terms of quantum loop gravity, you kind of alluded to it there. Is that not dependent on string theory? Do we not need string theory for this? Because obviously, I know string theory is very debatable because there's lots of mathematical proofs for it. There's many different types of string theory. We can never test it, not this moment in time. Are you happy not using string theory? Because a lot of people think we do need string theory.
I know various people say we need string theory. I respect these people. I respect this their opinion. I respectfully disagree. Very strongly. Loop quantum gravity does not need string theory, does not need higher dimension, which we haven't seen so far, does not need supersymmetry, which we haven't seen so far. It's a attempt to solve the problem of quantum gravity, which is completely independent of string theory. Now, it might be that both are right in some sense. We don't know. But by itself, loop quantum gravity has nothing to do with string theory. It is also... It also has a different aim. Loop quantum gravity, which is a theory of quantum gravity, which I think is more promising, just try to solve the problem, just in quotes, just tries to solve the problem of quantum gravity. So bringing together what we have understood about matter with quantum mechanics and what we have understood about space and time with generativity. So bring together generativity and quantum mechanics, which means, it's not a small thing, which means understanding the early universe, the beginning of the universe, the center of black holes and the structure of space and small time and all these things. String theory was more ambitious. String theory was an attempt to make a unified theory of all interactions. So much more ambitious. Quantum gravity doesn't want to go there. We don't have a unified theory of interaction. We don't even have a unified theory of the weak interaction and strong interactions. So in my opinion, we're very far from a unified theory, even if there is a unified theory. Unified theory means what Maxwell did with electricity and magnetism, so showing that there are two aspects of the same thing. Or what the Bain-Bessalam theory did with electromagnetism and the weak interactions. That was very beautiful. But we haven't even worked out the unification between the weak interaction and strong interaction. In fact, we have, and wrote the grand unified theory, which had a very good predictions, which is proton decay with a number, which turned out to be false. I have colleagues that spend all their life to test the prediction of the grand unified theory that the proton would decay within 10 to the 33 or whatever years lifetime, and it turned out to be false. The beautiful SU5 unified theory is just not right. God didn't like it. So we don't have a unified theory of the interaction without gravity. We don't have a unified theory with interaction with gravity. With a lot of things of the world we don't know. We just have to accept our ignorance. String theory was a beautiful attempt. In my opinion, it hasn't delivered. In the 80s, which now is a long time ago, people were hoping that within months, using string theory, one would have been able to compute the parameters of the standard model, right? Which would have been the success, fantastic success. Standard model has, 10, 20, 19 parameters. Just numbers you have to write there, and you don't know where they come from. And string theory has basically no parameter, at least that's what people thought in the 80s. And so it was a fantastic research problem. Here is a great theory, and out of it, we're going to compute the parameter of the standard model. And this would have been like, you know, the Schrödinger equation with the periodic table of the elements, the structure of the elements in chemistry depend on the periodic table. There are all these funny parameters in it, and then with the Schrödinger equation, with quantum mechanics, you just compute all of them out of the Planck constant, the charge of the electron, and that's it. All of them are computed. Fantastic. So when physics does these things, it's great. So string theory promised that in the 80s, and everybody got excited. And now it's 30 years later, and nobody's not even trying anymore because string theory doesn't allow to compute the parameters of the standard model. String theory predicted supersymmetry, and I've spent all my life hearing colleagues saying, well, next month we're going to see supersymmetry uncertain, I'm sure. And supersymmetry hasn't shown up. The big hype about the discovery of the Higgs at CERN, to some extent, served to hide the fact that, to hide the big disappointment that everybody was sure that as soon as you turn the LHC on at CERN, supersymmetry would show up. It didn't. So there's something wrong in those ideas, there's no doubt. Of course, supersymmetry could exist at higher energies, we don't know. But when a theory keeps making predictions and promises that are disappointed, after a while, I think is in difficulty. And I think now young people are much less attracted to string theory than to alternatives. Now, loop quantum gravity is making promises, so it could go down the same negative road. But so far, the open problems have been solved, the theory is going ahead, so I see it as an alternative to strings.